Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Many feel feminism is no longer needed because women and girls have come a long way historically. But still, many forms of sexism exist today. The negative effects of sexism on teens is powerful. Dr. Gail Pittman, psychology and women's studies professor at Sacramento City College, discusses her book, Sexism from A to Z. Dr. Pittman, first, I'd like to welcome you to 411 Teen.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great. And joining me here at the roundtable, I welcome students Hannah Riggs. Hannah is in the 10th grade. She attends Sale High School, music, theater, SGA, history, and math, to name a few, are her thing.
Hi, great to be here.
Glad to have you. Ariana Richardson also attends Sale. She's a senior. Cooking and dancing and acting, they turn her on.
Hey.
Karina Arrington, she attends Sale. She's in the 11th grade. Art, music, and massage therapy.
Hi.
Anais Suarez is a student at Florida High in the 10th grade. She's into band, planning, music, flag football.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Helen Abernathy, Florida High, senior, SGA Dance Marathon.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And Lauren Shirley. Lauren is a senior at Florida High. She's also into SGA, journalism, yearbook, and traveling.
Great to be back.
I'm always glad to have you. Dr. Pittman, what was the impetus for writing feminism from A to Z?
So I teach at Sacramento City College. Most of my students are adults or young adults. And many of them, when they take my Psychology of Women class, have really just started to begin to learn about feminism. It's really in the context of that class that they learn about it. And what I generally find for my students is that as they become more awakened to the realities of sexism and racism and other forms of intersecting oppressions and the way that that's impacted their lives, number one, they often feel really angry. And number two, they also feel like, oh my gosh, I wish I'd known this earlier. I wish that someone had told me about, the fact that maybe the reason that I'm not getting called on in math class is because that there's a perception of girls not being able to do math. Or maybe the reason why teachers are responding to me by ignoring me is because I'm an African-American female and there's racism and sexism that's intersecting with that. I think it's really important for girls to recognize that the things that they experience in life may not always have to do with them, meaning that they're outside cultural forces, social, psychological, cultural forces that are influencing the things that are happening to them. And that if they have that context and that understanding, that could really be incredibly helpful as they navigate the often rocky path of adolescence. And so it occurred to me that, I think teens are ready for this. I think teens would actually really appreciate learning about feminist theory and feminist concepts and ways to take action that are meaningful.
Well, you were certainly on target because I know before we started the program, we were just kind of talking, and several of the teen panelists admitted that they didn't know what feminism was because I was asking how many of them were feminists, and they said, well, we really don't know. So will you share with us just what feminism is and what it may mean to teens in addition?
Yeah. Well, I think that's where it gets a little complicated and where there's not really one single right answer, which is probably one of the reasons why it's hard to decide, oh, am I a feminist or not? Because I'm not really sure I know what it is. The reality is that there's a variety of feminist definitions and theories, and different people come at feminism from a range of different perspectives. But I think that a bottom line that probably most, if not all, feminists would agree with is that no one should be prevented or barred from achieving their goals or pursuing their dreams or accessing whatever they'd want to do in life because of their gender, or for that matter, because of their race or because of their sexual orientation or because of their transgender or non-transgender status, that those factors, those shouldn't be factors that prohibit some people from achieving what they want to achieve and make it easier for other people to achieve what they want to achieve. And how we go about actually making that happen and making it reality, I think, is where there's a lot of differences and room for various opinions. But I find it really interesting that for many people, feminism, I think especially for girls, for teen girls and young adult women, feminism is almost like they agree that girls and women should have, you know, access to education and equal pay and, you know, all the things that we want to have access to in life. But they hesitate at calling themselves a feminist. And I think it's because there's so much baggage attached to that word. There's so many stereotypes. And there's also kind of a rocky feminist history that ties in with all this as well.
Okay. You describe your in your book that you have, you describe it as a toolbox. And what tools do teens need to navigate forms of sexism and oppression today? What would be some of the tools that you are referring to? And then I'm going to let the teens ask you questions that they may have.
Yeah. Each chapter, so Feminism from A to Z, obviously that's the title of the book, and as the title implies, there are 26 chapters following the letters of the alphabet. And so each chapter, among other things, includes an activity. It's called a Try This. And those really are some of the tools that teens can use to activate, to inform themselves, to inform others. And I think that that's why I really refer to it as a toolbox, because there's really a range of things that we can have at our disposal to address sexism and other forms of oppression. But whether or not we use a particular tool depends on who we are, and it also depends on what the situation is. So sometimes a tool might be merely just informing ourselves about a particular topic, reading about it, doing some research, going online, etc. Sometimes it might be informing others, and there are some activities that I include in Feminism from A to Z that are kind of more creative ways of informing close friends, a wider circle of people, or the general public. And then there are tools that can help teens become more involved in various types of issues, whatever, you know, issues seem to interest them. Things like sexism in the media, or racism in the media, for that matter. Instead of just being exposed to it, learning how to recognize it, identify when it's happening, and then engage in various efforts to try to change it, whether it involves contacting the company or the advertisers or getting involved with media advocacy groups. There's just a wide range of different options that are available to teens. And I think that's really important when doing any kind of social justice work, because I think it can really wear us down to see the various ways in which people are oppressed. And to becoming aware is really the first step, but it's also, it's very tiring. I mean, it's a lot to take in and realize, you know, the baggage that we carry as a result of interlocking oppressions. And for us to have some tools to be able to handle it and to push back and to use our voice, I think is critical, partly in terms of changing the culture and also in terms of building self-esteem.
Do you all have comments, questions?
What are the stereotypes towards feminists? Because I might not have heard them.
Oh, okay. I'm actually curious. I don't know if this is appropriate, but I'm curious to hear maybe from some other folks if you've heard other stereotypes. I mean, I can certainly rattle off some that my students share, but I wonder if other people have some that you've heard.
Do you? Yeah.
I wouldn't say stereotypes. I've just heard a bunch of jokes, like, online about feminism.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I feel like there's kind of like a stigma with feminism that men don't really grasp it, because when you're in a position where you don't feel oppressed, then you see no change needing to happen. So I feel like that they get the message that women are trying to be above men or something when it's really an equality thing, as she was talking about. So yeah, that's one of the stereotypes that I
see. I think you're right. Absolutely. I think that men occupy a very many men feel like they occupy a very uncomfortable position when it comes to feminism, because I think you're right. There's some men that are, you know, thinking, oh my gosh, are women trying to be better than men? Are they trying to achieve more power than men? Are they trying to take away something from us? And the reality is that I think once males can realize that feminism is not about having power over another group, it's about having shared power and shared resources, it's an easier thing to digest and an easier thing to understand. But I think for many men, feminism feels threatening. It feels like a scary, threatening mm-hmm. kind of thing.
So really what we're talking about is there is definitely a need to educate males also.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's a variety of opinions about whether or not men can call themselves feminists, or, you know, mm-hmm. you know, we can go into verbal acrobatics about whether or not you can actually use a label. But I personally think that not only can men call themselves feminists, but I think we need men to call themselves feminists, because we can't do this alone. I mean, girls and women are strong and powerful, but this is a significant worldwide cultural shift, you know, engaging in feminist work. And we need all hands on deck, and men need to be on board, too. And I think many men are on board, but they're afraid to say so because of many of the stereotypes associated with feminism. Or they're afraid that calling themselves a feminist is going to take their man card away, and that feels threatening, too.
So really what we're talking about is empowering females.
Absolutely.
And all different aspects of empowerment.
Yes, absolutely. A lot of my book, we look at power in the book in a variety of different ways, but there's a number of activities that really encourage, they're designed to help girls find their voice, mm-hmm. or maybe find parts of their voice that they haven't really tapped into before. And to find their power and find ways of using it. And I think that when that becomes available to girls and women, then anything is possible.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with Dr. Gail Pittman. She is a professor of psychology and women's studies at Sacramento City College. I also have students joining me from Sale High School and from Florida High. We're going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm talking with Dr. Gail Pittman at Sacramento City College. We are looking at feminism. Dr. Pittman, how would you identify the role of the media when it comes to feminism?
Boy, that's a really good question. I don't know how short my answer is going to be. I think the media is incredibly powerful, probably more powerful than we give it credit, because I wish I had the exact statistic, because it would be very powerful to share this, but I read mm-hmm. somewhere maybe about a year ago or so that when we think about the number of actual human beings that we are in contact with on a daily basis versus the number of media images of human beings that we're in contact with on a daily basis, overwhelmingly, the media wins. Like, we're basically connecting more with images of people than we are with real people. And that cuts across race, that cuts across class, that cuts across gender. It's just a trend that we see in our modern day culture, you know, where we have access to increasing forms of technology. And so there's no way that the media can't have an impact when we look at things like that. Girls at a fairly early age learn to judge themselves based on media representations on a variety of levels. So at fairly young ages, girls become more at risk of developing body image concerns.
Mm-hmm.
They notice the size of mm-hmm. girls and women. They notice the age of girls and women, and that, you know, younger is better because young people tend to be overrepresented in the media. They get ideas about what it means to be a person of color. And the reality is that when you look over the last, well, really over the last 50 years, the representations of people of color in the media have not even remotely kept pace with what the actual populations are in the United States. And so, generally speaking, people of color aren't seeing themselves reflected back in a way that white people are. And so, you know, people who are gay or lesbian or transgender, we see more representations, but they're still not diverse, and mm-hmm. they tend to be very, very stereotyped. And so when that's what we have access to, when the majority of, quote-unquote, humans that we're seeing on a daily basis are not necessarily real humans, I mean, they're real, but they're being projected on a screen or as an image, that has a very powerful, that's a powerful force in the way that we end up seeing the world and our position in it. Now, what's also interesting about the media is that it also is a very powerful tool for activism. I mean, I think a perfect example right now is are the sexual harassment complaints that it seems like every day more and more of them are coming forward, starting with Harvey Weinstein and mm-hmm. continuing with other very powerful, very famous people being accused, and more women and men actually feeling, you know, empowered and emboldened to step forward. So I think that the media can also be a tool. It can be a way to communicate. It can be a way to agitate, to inform. But it also very powerfully shapes our perceptions of how girls and women are supposed to act, what we're supposed to look like, mm-hmm. how we operate in the world. And it's not accurate. It's not an accurate representation of what actually exists in the real world.
Let me see. Anyone has questions, comments?
I'm not quite sure how to word this question. So if you need me to elaborate more, go ahead and tell me.
Okay.
A lot of my friends are bisexual and gender fluid, and they're mm-hmm. not quite sure where they should stand or what applies to
Great
them
question.
When it comes to a lot of the stereotypes and feminism, so could you, like, elaborate on that aspect specifically?
Sure, absolutely. I think as a larger culture, a lot of people are still, well, I think a lot of people are just uninformed about gender fluidity and various forms of sexuality, whether it's bisexuality or pansexuality or even other forms that may not necessarily have a real clean label attached to it. And I think because of that, perceptions of those particular groups of people are very limited. There aren't a lot of accurate media representations of people who are gender fluid, or actually of people who are bisexual or pansexual. And those that do exist tend to be very stereotyped. So I think it's challenging for people, girls especially, girls and people who identify across the gender spectrum, wherever they may be. I think it's hard to see themselves in the media, and they may not necessarily see themselves just in their everyday lives, depending on the access to community that they have. If there's an LGBTQ plus community that's active in their area or not, that can really be a factor. Whether there's visibility, whether there's safety or resources in someone's area, I think that makes a huge difference. I think the bottom line is that regardless of gender identity, personally, I think feminism applies to everyone, because we all play a role in this, and we're all impacted by sexism. Even folks who are gender fluid, the reality is that people who are not, to other people, clearly identifiable as male or female are often seen as threatening. When someone is different and they don't fit cleanly into a category or box that's been firmly established in someone's mind, it's really common for people to respond in fear. And when they respond mm-hmm. in fear, their future actions are not likely to be very well thought out. Fear often results in violence. Fear results in various forms of oppression. And so I think that that's the route that stereotypes can potentially go. But the benefit to people who are gender fluid or gender nonconforming or anywhere across the sexual orientation spectrum is that really when you're advocating for feminism, you're advocating for the idea that no one should be oppressed because of their gender, regardless of what their gender identity is, period. Whether it's female, male, gender fluid, gender queer, gender nonconforming, whatever it may be. And that if gender is a focus of a person's oppression, then feminism, I think, is one of the tools that can help dismantle that. Did that answer your question? Is that kind of what you were getting at?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
I was just going to say that I completely agree that it's not just women that have to be feminists. It's kind of like other groups that are progressive towards race, such as Black Lives Matter. You don't necessarily have to be Black or African American to be in that. It's just that you recognize that there's a problem there and you're willing to bridge the gap and talk about it.
Right, exactly. I think that's actually a really good analogy. And I think the other piece is recognizing that the flip side to sexism or racism or other forms of oppression is privilege. And for folks that are coming into the feminist conversation or the anti-racism conversation as someone who has privilege, I think it really becomes a matter of how can that person recognize their privilege and then use it in a way that's going to advance the good of everyone, you know, that's not going to infringe upon someone's rights or access or empowerment.
So, like I was going to say earlier with you saying about sexism, about feminism and all the other stuff, I never realized how, like, you're young, you are, like, brainwashed because you see all these cool cartoons and the TV shows and how you're supposed to act. I have a little sister who's, like, 9 years old, and she's getting raised under all that, too. And she's a chubby little girl. And when she see these beautiful women up here in a certain body image and a certain way they act, she'll try to act like them. And one day she'll come up to me and say, "Hey, why can't I be like everyone else?" And I'm telling her, I was like, "Don't be everyone else. Be yourself." So I never realized how young you are when you're like brainwashed by what you see on TV and what you hear on everywhere, like on media sites and stuff like that.
That's so true. Actually, it breaks my heart to hear that. But I also know that it's a really common story. And I'm so glad that you are an advocate for her and that you remind her anytime she's kind of down on herself, that you remind her, you know, you are exactly who you're supposed to be and don't ever try to be anybody else because you're who you are. And that's, you know, that's perfect. You know, the media doesn't care. Like, they're not out to make us feel good about ourselves. I mean, if you think about it, especially when you talk about advertising, their goal is to make us feel insecure because they want to convince us that whatever product they're selling us is the key to making us feel better about ourselves. You know, buy this makeup and look more beautiful. Buy this anti-aging product and look younger. Wear these jeans and look hot. You know, eat this food and lose weight. Or don't eat this food and lose weight. You know what I mean? Like, it just goes on and on. It's a whole system that capitalizes on our insecurities. And it works because otherwise people wouldn't spend, you know, these companies wouldn't spend the millions of dollars that they do on advertising. But I think that we need to recognize that it comes at a cost and that once we start to become more media aware of the images that are essentially being sold to us, if you will, then we can start to be more critical. You know, we can start to see those images for what they are and distance ourselves from how they're trying to convince us to feel bad about ourselves from who we are and, you know, like what we're really about.
Well, I think historically, our panelists need to understand that feminism addressed issues of the middle class, educated white women, and that you very seldom saw women of color. Even when you see, even today, now yes, you may see more, but you still there's still a paucity of women of color being involved and actively involved in feminism, simply because they feel like they really are not addressing issues that impact or affect them. Do you think, I know that has changed some, you would agree, Dr. Pittman?
Yeah, but I also think you bring up a really important point, and it's something that I talk about pretty extensively in the book, that the reality is that when we look at who's been involved in feminist activism, it's typically women who have privilege, you know, mm-hmm. and that oftentimes is translated in, most of the time, is translated into white women who are middle class and well educated, because these are women who had time, they had money, you know, they're the ones that are able to go out and stage a rally or host some other form of protest or what have you, or engage in some other form of activism. And I think the other thing to recognize is that when you only have, when you have a limited set of people representing a limited set of groups that are out there fighting for women, right, mm-hmm. fighting for all of us, it's very likely that you're only going to get a limited number of perspectives. And I think a perfect, well, there's lots of examples, but you can go all the way back to the suffrage movement from right. the late 1800s to the early 1900s, and see that not only were women of color, particularly African-American women, not really invited to the table, but there was a tension between white women and African-Americans in general. And one of the strategies that some white women suffragists used was to pit white women against African Americans and make the mm-hmm. argument to white men, essentially saying, hey, if you give us the right to vote, then, you know, we'll be able to form a coalition and we'll have more power over African Americans. We'll be able to prevent them from getting the vote because you don't want them to get the vote, do you? I mean, this is really oppressive yeah. stuff. And so right. I think it's important to make note of that history and to understand why I think especially, well, many women of color, but I think especially African-American women might be reluctant to join, you know, to label themselves as a feminist, given that history. I think another example comes with the 1960s and 70s and the reproductive rights movement, you know, with the Roe v. Wade decision and the use of the birth control pill and other contraceptive measures. That, in many ways, is extraordinarily empowering for women to be able to have control of their own bodies. And if we look at the history of Planned Parenthood and Margaret Sanger's role in it, some of her motives are questionable. I mean, the jury is kind of out, and there's debate historically mm-hmm. about what her motives were. But the reality is that the earliest clinics were placed in poor urban areas, mostly populated with African-American women. And there were some real questions about whether her motive was to try to limit the growth of the African-American population by providing them with birth control. And so when you have that level, when you have that kind of thing going on and mistrust potentially growing and coupled with, you know, not listening to some of the real issues that are going on for folks, including but not limited to poverty and racism and, you know, access to education, I think that it becomes very challenging. So I think it's important to put it on the table because it's real. And I mm-hmm. agree that it's gotten better and that we certainly see many more women of color, people of color in general, being active voices for the feminist movement. We still have some work to do.
Indeed. Do you all have any other questions, comments? Because I have one and I wanted to bring up. And mine was, is there a different position for celebrities? And because I think of celebrities and are they just paying lip service to feminism? Now, I love Beyonce, so don't get me wrong. I'm not getting on Beyonce. Uh-huh. But is she paying lip service? Is there a different standard because you are a celebrity and a female?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's funny that you bring up Beyonce because I'm not kidding you. Like, people in academia, like in college and graduate school, like, people write dissertations about Beyonce.
Okay.
And whether she's a feminist, you know, she mm-hmm. legit, you know, is she legit in her feminism? Like, what's this about? You know, I think that in some ways, just to give celebrities a little bit of a break, and then I'll get into the more critical side of it. Mm-hmm. You know, they're in a very public position, more so now than ever. I mean, anything you say is basically on the record and can get tweeted out or, you know, otherwise shared on social media in an instant. And so if a person doesn't choose their words carefully or if they say something kind of in the moment but it's maybe not exactly what they intended, boy, it's really hard to undo that because it becomes public in a matter of seconds. Mm-hmm. And then you know what happens from there. It just kind of takes off and has a life of its own. But I also think that celebrities have a responsibility, that if they're going to take on a cause, whether it's working for any type of social justice cause, anti-racism, anti-sexism, you know, anti-homophobia, whatever form of oppression they're focusing on, they have a responsibility to carry that message forward and to do so thoughtfully. And I don't know, I think some people do it more thoughtfully than others. I also think that the way that we perceive celebrities makes a difference, too. I mean, I think, for example, when Emma Watson addressed the UN, you know, from a feminist standpoint and, you know, made her speech, I thought it was great. Personally, I thought that it was great that she did that, but I also found some very problematic statements that she had made, and that her perspective really was coming from a white middle class kind of standpoint and not necessarily being inclusive of other groups. And yet I didn't see her get, I mean, she got a little, you know, she got criticized somewhat, but if anything, I saw more people coming to her defense, you know, saying, well, hey, you know, she's an iconic, you know, celebrity. She's, you know, a famous actor. And, you know, here she is representing women at the UN and, you know, like, give her a break.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, but we'll get right back at you.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm talking with Dr. Gail Pittman. Dr. Pittman, I had to interrupt you.
That's okay. I was kind of rambling.
Oh, okay.
I'll keep it relatively short. What I was going to say is that I think sometimes there's a double standard. This is the more succinct way to put it. I think sometimes there's a double standard as to how we judge celebrities based on how they approach social justice issues. And I was using Emma Watson and Beyonce as an example. Mm-hmm. I think Beyonce, I mean, I have some issues there as well. But I also think that she gets criticized much, much more than white women who identify as feminists. And I think that's just something for us collectively to take a look at.
Okay. Well, you know, some say we're living in a post-feminist world. What's your position on that?
Wow. Well, we were living in a post-feminist world. A man who publicly admitted to... I'm not even going to say the word.
I know.
You know what I'm referring to.
Right.
You know, who publicly admitted to engaging in some pretty lewd acts against women, wouldn't be president.
Right.
You know, that's just, I mean, I can give any more examples, but that's the, you know, the most basic one that comes to mind.
Okay. Do you all have any questions? Go for it.
To comment on that, I think that this day and age, coming like as a teenager, I haven't seen huge feminist movements as they were in, like, I don't know, the 50s or like with suffrage in the 30s or so. But I think it's still a big deal, especially with like sexual harassment in the workplace and in a professional setting, as you've seen with the Anchorman. Forgot his name momentarily. But it's like there's a recent poll said that 1 in 5 women don't report being sexually harassed in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And that's such an awful thing that this day and age, like, it still happens. And I think like 88%, that could be totally wrong. I think a UK study did on
Ooh, that's a big number.
Of women possibly being like women that have been harassed in the workplace or harassed in a professional setting in general, like, it's a very overall, like, overwhelming percentage, and it's still such a big problem, sexual harassment and just, like, I don't know, anti-feminism kind of stuff like that. I don't really know the exact word to say there. Sexism, yeah, there it is. Mm-hmm. it's still such a big thing, and I feel like people who just don't, I don't know, a lot of people don't see it because there's not a one collective big movement happening, I don't think. And I think that's why people aren't seeing it as much as it used to be seen.
Yeah, you know, I think, I mean, I agree on some level that, you know, like, culturally we're kind of caught in an interesting time because we're in a time where girls and women, everyone really, has so many rights available to us, more than ever before. But yet we still have a long way to go, and we're in the midst of a political climate where rights are being taken away from us left and right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually, and don't take this, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but I actually think in some ways that the election of our current president was a blessing in disguise. And what I mean by that is that there's many things I really don't like about it, but I think it's waking people up. Yeah. I think it's making people realize that maybe we aren't as far as we thought we were, or maybe we can't rest on our laurels, and maybe we do need to, you know, get down to business and get active. I think that, you know, if anything, we've been seeing people who are sexist and racist and, you know, oppressive on many levels coming out of the woodworks because they feel more emboldened to speak up and speak out. I mean, we're seeing all these KKK rallies.
Yeah.
For example. And so I think that is a powerful tool for people who want to be involved in social justice efforts or who care about those things but maybe haven't been involved before, because the time is ripe for action, and there's many ways that we can take action.
Go right ahead.
Okay. So like you said before about the feminine and the KKK rallies and stuff like that, I say I agree with, like, how we need to, like, it was a wake-up call for more people. My mom, she always kept me sheltered from all, try to keep me sheltered from all the bad things, but still seep through. And, like, we need to start, like, now. Like, when we see little people, little babies out there, we gotta make sure they're rocks and stuff, because my mom was my rock and she always gives me advice. She always tells me, like, don't let nobody push you down. And it's important that little babies need to know that their generation is coming up.
Exactly.
And we should let that, like, show them the way, like, violence is never the answer, and then, like, sexism and then feminists and then violence and all the other stuff, like, all the good things and all the bad things in the world. We just got to get them prepared. Not, like, telling them all the bad, crazy things,
right,
scaring them to death, but we can start slowly.
Well, I think
right,
you raised some great issues, Ariana, and I think one thing I wanted to interject here is, what about the teen magazines? We haven't talked about them. But teen magazines, what message are they sending? Are they counterproductive? And I'd like to hear your opinion on it.
There was a meme that was going around on social media, on Facebook, maybe on Instagram. Oh, my gosh, I'm not going to remember the name of the magazine. I think it was Girls Life. Maybe some of you have saw this, where they had the image of the real cover on one side, and then on the other side they had a photoshopped one. And the real one was, you know, I mean, this is a magazine that's directed towards, I don't know, maybe 10, 11, 12-year-olds,
right,
so not quite teenagers. And, you know, it had a image of a girl that was very sexualized. You know, she was wearing a lot of makeup, and just, you know, she looked more mature than her actual age. And all the articles that were listed on the cover were about how to lose weight, how to find a boyfriend, you know, different, you know, ways of kissing. You know what I mean? Like, the stuff that's, you know, I don't know, not, it just, it's kind of par for the course of what you see in girls and teen magazines. And then the one on the right, the one that was photoshopped, was of a regular girl dressed in regular clothes, you know, like no makeup, no low cleavage or anything like that. I mean, just like dressed like a 10-year-old girl would be dressed.
Mm-hmm.
And all the headlines that were on the magazine cover were about educating yourself or being active or learning about science and math or, you know, being out in nature, like things that are much more empowering and much more grounding. And so I actually showed that to my daughter, who's almost 10, and she couldn't, I mean, she's a little young for those kinds of magazines, mm-hmm. but she could not believe the real one, you know, like it's just so inappropriate. But that's what's sold to our
exactly.
girls.
Exactly.
And then that's what they learn to aspire to. You have to look good, you have to lose weight, you have to present yourself a certain way. You have to find a boyfriend, which I think is really dangerous. Not that necessarily dating is a bad thing, but when girls are getting that at such a young age, what the research is showing is that the earlier that girls start dating, and especially when they're getting a boyfriend, the more they neglect their studies. Mm-hmm. And they're more likely to spend time with the boyfriend than they are doing schoolwork or extracurricular activities or things that encourage their growth and development. And that's really sad that at such a young age is what they're being taught to value.
Okay. Yeah.
I wanted to add that when I was younger, like 9, 10, I would get into all the young adult magazines and I'd read them like they were religious material. And like,
I did
all
too,
of my
actually.
Them, it was all about these things that were telling us that we had to be the size of somebody's pinky and we had to look oh so fabulous and gorgeous all the time. And after a while I hit rock bottom with all that because I realized I couldn't afford to do all the things that society was mm-hmm. broadcasting that someone my age should do. And I personally was like, all right, cut the crap. This is just insane.
Well, good for you. That's great that you saw that.
You.
Yes.
And now I'll see like little kids reading these magazines and I'll just be like, you do realize that's not
real.
How you should be.
Mm,
you're supposed to be young, playing.
The images that are presented are unrealistic. That's
completely.
That's an important point that we kind of have skirted. They aren't realistic. You know, it's different strokes for different folks. Everybody's not supposed to look the same way. Okay.
Yeah.
So
right.
That's important.
Exactly.
We've got two more questions here and I had a ton of things that I wanted to ask you, you know, like how you felt feminism intersected with Christianity, but we're not going to deal with that. Go with your question.
Adding on to the teen magazines, I think that also social media has a big tie into that, and social media and like magazines and TV and stuff like that has kind of brought like young women to want to grow up faster and want to mature uh-huh. quicker. And I think that social media and with teen magazines, they kind of have this facade that like growing up kind of is like sexualized in a way, or like maturity or adulthood. And I think it plays on that, how young girls want to be seen as adults, or they want to grow up as adults, and that kind of turns into more of a sexual thing. Or sexualized, and then magazines play on, you know, girls' insecurities, and that's so wrong. And I never, when I was little, I never got into stuff like that until I was, like, 13, and I started reading Teen Vogue, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that Teen Vogue, to me, was very, I don't know, I feel like Teen Vogue is, like, not one of the worst ones, but although all their, obviously all their images are photoshopped, and they're very unrealistic, but they did one on like gender fluality or gender fluid, mm-hmm. and I think that they're not magazines. They're I don't know. Some of them are trying.
Okay.
I think Teen Vogue really is trying. Actually, they've been putting out some great articles lately,
yeah.
and they have some room to grow for sure. But I'm optimistic.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Also, going off of what Hannah was saying earlier, I heard her mention, like, sexual assault and that kind of stuff going on. And I feel like magazines mm-hmm. play a huge role in that because you're
Good
introduced.
Point.
Yeah, you're introduced to a lot of sexual things when we're really young. And I feel like women are taught that being a sexual being is kind of, like, okay and not okay. But you're just kind of silenced about that because, I don't know, I wrote my college application essay on college sexual assaults, and there's actually 11% of college women are sexually assaulted, but about, like, I believe it was 5% only go reported.
Right.
So
yeah.
that 95%, it's just insane. So women obviously feel that they can't talk about it because of the stigma of, like, being a sexual being and that you can't say no or, like, things like that, so...
Good point.
Sure. Oftentimes, they think they blame, you know, they blame themselves, or it's, you know, and it occurs in a private context, and so it's really a he said, she said kind of thing. And they realize, you know, even if I bring a case forward, I'm not going to win. You know, they're not going to take this on. And I think a lot of them were worried about being questioned about, you know, well, why were you wearing what you were wearing, or why were you playing, or why were you drinking, or why were you doing this? And, you know, none of that is relevant, but people make it relevant as a way of deflecting responsibility off the perpetrator.
Okay, you had questions.
Okay, so, like, saying off of the magazine and the body imaging, it makes me so angry when somebody, like, a random person walk up to me. Like, one time I was at the gym, which makes me so mad. Why people body shame people at the gym? Like,
that's what you're at the gym
there for. One person walked up to me as I was on the treadmill. My headphones weren't working, so I was just doing it, listening to the music on the radio. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, they were playing Justin Bieber. That's all I remembered. And after the guy walked up to me and said, "You look good." And I was like, "Thank you." And I kept walking, I said, "You look better if you lose weight." And I looked at him.
Oh, my God.
I looked at him. And then, like the inner me was like, "Cuss him out, cuss him out, cuss him out. If you don't do it now, I will." I slowly calmed down. I faced the wall, and I kept doing what I was doing. And he said it again. I looked at him. And then I looked at the little line where it tells you how far you've been going. Mm-hmm. I told him, "Look at how long I've been doing this for. What you think I'm here for? Like, for real. You need to stop. Go over there, lift your little weights, go ahead and walk away." Which, and I was going to say something else, but that kept me. I was about to say, "With your chicken leg self." Oh, my God. I was ready to tear him out. And that's before, like, YNCA closed down. And then body shaming is just, like, everywhere now. Like, you got to be this way and this way. And that's why I go to school and I see people who are like, "I don't like the way my body is." And I say, "I don't like the way the body is, but I'm changing it." And I'll tell people, say, "Girl, you look flawless today. Don't worry about what other people say. Mm-hmm. Worry about what those people who are telling you the truth is."
Well, let me just say this to you all. How about plastic surgery? Now, with the exception of those who have had, you know, been in an accident or have some real, disfigurement, is plastic surgery a feminist act? And I throw that out there.
I think that a feminist act, can you elaborate?
Is it a feminist act? If you're having plastic surgery, you're altering, and I'm just asking you, I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but that just came up when you all were talking about how you look. And I think about some of these young women who, again, I'm not talking about those who may have some disfigurement. Don't get me wrong. That aside, or may have been in an accident or whatever. Who wants their nose to look like...
Nicki Minaj.
That's right.
I'm a sophomore. I'm 15, but, like, I've had my own insecurities, but not, like, not coming from, like, what I see in social media or from other people. Like, I have plans to, like, get eyelash extensions and stuff like that, but that's because that's, like, what I prefer myself, you know? I'm not, like, jealous of other people who have full lashes and stuff like that. That's, you do you, you know. And if someone wants to enhance, something or, you know, change something, if that's making them happy, then I don't think that's a problem, you know. But maybe it's not necessarily, like, something that, I don't know, that's encouraged, maybe. Mm-hmm. But, like, if you're happy, you're happy. If you're trying to look like someone else, that's a little, I don't know, you do you.
Well, listen, we are out of time. I told you we wouldn't have enough time. And they're looking at me going, oh, but Dr. Gail Pittman, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and sharing your book with us. That's it for this hour. To my listening audience, again, I appreciate your time and your ear. And I invite you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Teen archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.